Carly-Anne, welcome to Waterstones.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
We are here to talk about your debut novel, The Ministry of Time, and I would like you actually to begin by pitching this novel to me, if you can, because it is so bonkers and brilliant, but I would struggle to put it succinctly, and I think you probably will have a nice, neat way of summing it all up.
I've worked it down into a one-line pitch.
Perfect.
Which is, it is a time travel romance about bureaucracy, empire, and cigarettes.
Okay.
And see, that really works, because I say that and people are like, it's cigarettes, bureaucracy. It's great. It gives me time to like plan my next move while they try to pass it.
They try and struggle. Yes. Do you know what? I mean, that's not what I had written down exactly, but it's pretty close.
That's good.
It is, as you say, it is a time travel romantic comedy. But maybe you can explain sort of where we find ourselves at the beginning of this book, because your narrator does a similar thing of sort of going, okay, just to sort of set the scene, this is where we're at.
So the book opens on a man called Graham Gore, Commander Graham Gore, who is a polar explorer who's part of a doomed Victorian Arctic expedition. He doesn't know it's doomed yet. And as he's charging through the Arctic tundra, the world splits open in front of him and he is dragged from the Arctic into a laboratory in 21st century London, where he's told, welcome to the future. Everyone you've ever known and loved is dead. The British Empire has collapsed. We are doing an experiment to see if time travel actually works. So we need you to live here. And we need you to assimilate to the 21st century. To this end, we've assigned you a bridge. So this narrator she's only ever known as the bridge. Mm. And she works as a bridge between Victorian England for Graham Gore and 21st century London. And she's a civil servant. She's quite an unusual woman. She's very ambitious. You know, she has a very interesting relationship with power, with control. She's mixed race. She's British Cambodian. She has a very interesting relationship with her heritage, with the British state. And she inevitably ends up having a very interesting relationship with Graham Gore, because they have to live together in this little house for a year. She has to monitor him. She has to watch him. She has to report on him. And she, you know, inevitably becomes quite invested in him, to put it delicately.
Sounds like a euphemism for something.
But as they grow closer, as housemates, friends, something more, the shape of the project that brought them together, you know, sinister government ministry that has brought people into the past, oh, I'm sure they're only doing a normal time travel experiment. No, of course there is something else going on. And they slowly start to uncover this.
That was, again, a very expertly done job there of sort of explaining how things are set up at the beginning. As you say, he's not the only person that has been pulled from the past. This idea being that to test time travel safely, they would bring people who were going to die and bring them out of that and then transport them to the present day. And what I really loved, one of the things I loved about this book was that there is an inherent comedy, I suppose, by bringing people out of time and into the world that we sort of know and recognise. And it reminded me slightly, and I hope you don't mind this, of the TV series Ghosts. Because, oh.
I love Ghosts, and I'm so thrilled by that comparison.
Because you've got these various characters who are from different periods of time, going all the way back to sort of the 16th, 17th century, who, through the course of the book, do have a bit of contact with each other. And I loved the way that those relationships start to build as well. And they almost sort of have this sort of, I guess, this connection as apart from their bridges, where they're sort of, because they're sharing this experience of being out of time. But tell me a bit about how you chose which sort of periods of time to pick people from and how you assembled your cast. We'll come back to Graham Gore later.
Before I do that, I want to say that I love Ghosts so much. That is the most flattering comparison. Thank you so much. I love that TV series. So the other expats, as they're called, the other expats from history, for the two other main expats, the ones that we see the most of in the book, one is called Margaret Kemble. She comes from the Great Plague of London. And one is Arthur Reginald Smythe, who comes from the Battle of the Somme. And in both of those cases, I wanted to pick points in history that are very culturally resonant for, you know, the British cultural imagination. Our sense of national identity is very tied up with these points in history. So the First World War, for example, the kind of Jacobean England and the plague. So I wanted them to appear to the reader as if they were representative of an era, but of course they're not representative at all.
Mm.
They are completely their own people. They are total individuals. They don't respond to the world. They don't act in a way that you might expect a stereotypical Edwardian man, for example, to react. And that's because I wanted to really draw attention to this idea of history as a narrative.
Mm.
Like we narrate and we decide what history actually means, when in fact the individuals who lived in it are, you know, will defy expectations. For the other two expats you see a little bit less of, Anne Spencer, who comes from the French Revolution, and Thomas Cardingham, who comes from the English Civil War. In both of those cases, I asked my friends, can you pick a disaster with such a large body count that if I remove someone, it wouldn't affect history? And those are the ones they picked.
There, as I said, there is this sort of this initial comedy of people finding themselves, you know, in a completely different society. You have a lot of fun with politically correct language and things like that. But there's quite a serious undertone to this, which is that, of course, you, as you say in the book, all of these people are effectively refugees from their time, and that your bridge character is working for the government and has this expertise in dealing with language and this idea, and has her own experience, of course, a personal experience of being from a family that was a refugee family as well. Tell me a little bit about why that was a really key theme, and of course how you balance a very serious theme like that in a perhaps not so serious sounding book.
It's a good question. It took 9 drafts to get here. So I was really interested not only in the idea of history as a narrative, but also time travel as a kind of metaphor for forced immigration, because these expats from history, although they're called expats, you know, it's a very loaded term,
mm.
they really are refugees. They can't go back to their former eras, they never do. And they are, you know, they have to be rescued, essentially. They would otherwise have died. But of course, just because they have been rescued from a point of death, it doesn't mean that they are immediately well-adjusted or they're immediately grateful, you know, to a mm. host state. The experience of forced immigration is a very frightening one, and it can be sometimes a very humorous one. Seeing British culture from the outside, either from a different time period or a different culture, I think sometimes it can look quite ludicrous. Mm. So I was very, very interested in that, and I was interested in the parallel between the Bridges family and Graham Gore, a Victorian coming to 21st century London. Balancing humour and these deeper themes. One of the interesting things about writing this book is that a lot of people have said to me very kindly, very generously, it's very funny. How did you balance being funny with these serious themes? And I think, God, I did not mean to write a funny book. I didn't mean to. It just came out like that. Very embarrassed. Very sorry, everyone. Did not mean to crack all those jokes. But I will say that, so my all-time favourite writer is Terry Pratchett.
Right.
The great English humorist and fantasy writer. And he has said about humorous writing and funny books is that the opposite of funny is not serious. The opposite of funny is unfunny.
Mm.
The opposite of serious is unserious. You can use humour to convey difficult ideas that might otherwise be hard to confront or digest or bring into your heart. So I think humour can, in fact, as he puts it, I think humour can slide ideas under the door.
Mm. And for your unnamed narrator, because of her British Cambodian sort of status, if you like, and her family's history, she sees the experiment, I think, in a slightly different way to some of the other Bridges, has this very different perspective on it. And I'm presuming that that is informed by your own experience as a British Cambodian yourself. We'll get to some of the things that she's trying to sort of attack, I suppose, later in the chat. But again, it must be a question of balance for you, taking something which is probably quite a personal perspective, but then fictionalising it. Tell me a bit about that.
So this was a really interesting journey, because the very first version of The Bridge, as I say, I wrote 9 drafts,
mm.
the very first version of The Bridge was not British Cambodian.
Okay.
She was just a cipher. She was a sort of nobody. She was a reader stand-in, almost. Mm. And it wasn't until I started developing who she might be and what her relationship might be with the British state, particularly in the context of this ministry, that I thought I was interested in the idea of her being mixed race, white passing, and having this very ambiguous relationship. That's partly because I was trying to write another book at the time,
okay.
which was about, it was, you know, the big Cambodian novel, or so I hoped it would be. It's terrible, it will never see the light. about Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge and then the British Cambodian diaspora. And there was a character in that book who I thought, you know what, I think you'd work really well in this context. So I just took her out and I put her in it. Obviously, like many writers, I have drawn on some parts of my experience, but I think it is really important to say that the bridge is not me. It's not autobiographical. I've never lived with a time-travelling Victorian. You know, not for want of trying, but...
I got the sense that you... I mean, because at the back of my copy of the book, there is a picture of Graham Gore, who you should point out is a real person.
He was a real historical figure.
And he's sort of famous because on that doomed expedition, his note was the last thing that was written.
Yes.
The last piece of evidence, really, that we have to try and piece together what happened to those men. But it was really interesting having the picture of him at the end of the book, and I was like, I could imagine there'd be some women or men who would read the book and be like, hello, he's a bit of a Victorian dish. I wanted to know whether you had chosen him because of finding that picture and thinking, yes, I can write something around this person, or whether the who he was came later in the process of writing.
Oh, it absolutely started with Graham Gore. It absolutely started with me going, ooh, a Victorian dish, hello. It actually started entirely by accident. I didn't intend to write this book. As I said, I was writing another book that will never see the light of day. But I watched a TV series called The Terror during lockdown.
Right.
And The Terror is about, it's based on a book by Dan Simmons, also called The Terror. And it's about this lost expedition to the Arctic. Sir John Franklin's lost 1845 expedition to the Arctic, in which two ships and 129 men vanished and never came home. And I went on the Wikipedia page for Graham Gore for a series of quite random reasons, and just immediately, in the way that I fixated on things, and I think we all fixate on things during lockdown, I just thought, my God, this guy seems great. All, you know, his biography makes him seem like a very calm, competent, very kind man. People liked him very much. I really think that picture is very attractive. I know not everyone agrees with me, but you know, I'm fighting for his right to be a hottie. And the book really started as a kind of literary parlour game. I made a lot of friends online because at the time, you know, we couldn't really go outside, who were also interested in polar exploration, not just this expedition, but the kind of history of polar exploration. And I started writing the Ministry of Time, it was called something else then, as a joke. You know, what would it be like if your favourite polar explorer lived in a house with you?
Okay.
And I loved Graham Gore, so Graham Gore it was. He's such a minor figure otherwise in polar history that there's just not a lot of archival material, which is great because it meant I could make him up.
There's a whole lot of space that you can write into, basically.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think his status is about to be elevated by this book. There's going to be a lot more attention on his Wikipedia page.
Oh, I really hope so.
What's really interesting is that, again, one of the other things that I really enjoyed about this book is I suppose, the depiction of that burgeoning relationship between the bridge and Graham Gore. First of all, because of that proximity of a very modern woman and a Victorian gentleman, and then the way that they become closer. We've hinted at it. I think we're not going to spoil anything by saying that things develop. But beyond that, beyond some very good descriptions of basically falling in love with somebody, and also beyond some very good descriptions of like proper, what's almost like lockdown sex, I would say, because they're sort of stuck in this house in this very different...
You know, oh, yeah, absolutely.
But what you do is you take it even further, which is there's a description where she is talking about how by telling him things about her, she's deciding what she says about herself, what she reveals about herself. And she says it was about taking up space in his head. And then this is followed by a discussion about empire. And I thought, this is really interesting because... almost comparing the idea of taking up space in somebody's head with taking up space in somebody else's country. You're nodding your head, so I'm hoping I'm on the right track here, but tell me a little bit about that, because that seems to me to be a really, really interesting idea about how we relate to each other.
The colonization of mental space.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you pulled that out, actually, because one of the things about this relationship, it is a romance. They fall in love with each other, but... one of the things that excited me about this romance was not just the ways that they did connect and they did understand each other, but the ways they completely misunderstood each other. In the same way with the expats, I wanted to choose representational moments from British history and then have these people who were not representational at all. these two, this Victorian man and this 21st century woman, fundamentally misunderstand each other because they have made representations of what they think the other one is based on their context. And so sometimes with, always with love, you have to come willing to give up space, to take up space, to share space with obsession, with infatuation, which can happen at the same time as love. It can overlay love, it can take over love. That's something else. That's a kind of invasion. That's a looking at someone and wanting them to be a kind of person and then falling in love with that person. And I think there are elements of both love and obsession in this relationship. I mean, the bridge's job is to literally monitor this man. It's not a normal relationship.
When I'm reading a book in preparation for an interview, I do try to sort of make notes of things and lines and all the rest of it. And I actually found when I was reading this book that I was enjoying reading it so much that I kept forgetting to actually write the stuff down. So I would fold over the bottom of the page and be like, I'll come back to that later, but I know that's a good thing. And there was one line that I was like, that's a great line. And I was so pleased with myself for finding it until I realised that the line was actually printed on the back of the book as a really obvious quote to pull from. But it comes from this idea of their relationship, as I say, which I think is really brilliantly depicted. And again, it's this idea of what it means to fall for somebody. And the slight quote that I'll give here was, he was here by and with my body. He lives in me like trauma does. If you ever fall in love, you'll be a person who is in love for the rest of your life. That's the line that I underlined or failed to. And I love that line, but I also am intrigued by this idea again, because it connects to this idea of the inherited trauma that she talks about from her family. And this idea that falling in love with somebody is a bit like receiving a scar that you will carry with you for the rest of your life. Tell me a little bit about that. About what that really means, I suppose, to fall in love with somebody.
Again, I'm really glad you picked out these lines. You're picking out all the real humdingers that I'm really proud of. Thank you. There's another segment in the book where the bridge talks about you can't go into the world not expecting to harm people. You will harm people, you'll harm others, and you will be harmed. That is just what living is. And I think, I know, I wrote her. She is someone who, even over the course of this book, is on a journey. So there are two levels to the narration, really. There's her relating what happened in the past, and there's her reflecting on why she made these choices, why she acted the way she did, why she spoke to people the way she did, why she fell in love the way she did. And I think, as we were just saying about obsession and love, I think she realises that some of what she was doing was harmful. Not deliberately, not maliciously, but you just can't expect to go into any deeply intense and important interaction without expecting also that to be a vulnerable thing, and to not expect to receive some kind of wound. That sounds unnecessarily dark. I really don't think it is. I think it's important to accept that. You know, the Buddhist truism that life is suffering. That doesn't mean that life is terrible. It means that you will always, that the process of being alive is to, like, wanting things and then not having, being able to have those things, and, you know, pain comes out of desire because you're always trying to chase it. And the only way to free yourself from that is to free yourself from desire. I don't think the bridge is there. I don't think I'm there. You know, I like desiring things. I think it's, you know, keeps me going in the morning.
In that same section, actually, she's talking about how when you fuck up, sometimes that doesn't mean there's any great learning from that other than that you've messed up. And that there is something similar that she talks about with oppression, which is that what you need to do to learn something about oppression is to be able to step out of it and look at how it's built, the scaffolding of it, I think she says, so that you can look at where the weak joints are so that you can kick them in. We've spoken a little bit about how this book, you didn't intend to be a sort of entertaining or funny book, or maybe not so much as, you know, as readers might find it, which makes me think that there was a serious intent behind it. Is there a hope that it might kick some things in? And if so, what are you hoping to kick in?
I would love to kick some things in. I also love other people to feel like empowered to put on their kicking boots, kick things in. Again, this comes down to this idea of being representational. I don't think being traumatized or being oppressed teaches you anything intrinsically. I think I'd feel very pessimistic if that was the only way that we could teach or we could understand our actions and the actions of others. So the bridge is British Cambodian, as I am, and she has a very difficult relationship with that. She, at the beginning of the book, she tries not even to admit that she's not white because she's been mistaken as white. She thinks, well, it's just convenient for me really to pass as white, especially to a Victorian man. Maybe I just shouldn't talk about it. Because I think that there is a real fear in her that to start saying, oh, as a British Cambodian person, I think that you're wrong about this, or as a British Cambodian person, my experience is, because she's afraid of being pigeonholed in that way.
Mm.
And then, although that, you know, maybe she'll win an argument, or maybe she'll shut down a single person opposite her, she's afraid of being streamlined into, you know, into this box.
Mm.
Streamlined into this box, you know. We're putting a river in a box. I don't know what's going on in this metaphor anymore. So she's very frightened of that. But so she's going in the other direction. She's going in the wrong direction, I think. Mm. She's now saying, well, what if I don't engage with that at all?
Mm.
What if I don't engage with that at all and I just pretend I'm white? Which, again, is like a false way of being in the world. I can't remember where we started with this question. Sorry, I've just rambled on. But it's like, it's this, the kind of opposite fear.
Yeah.
That either you can say, well, I am my oppression, I am my trauma, and so this is what I'm offering you. But then how do you move outside of that? You can't outrun trauma.
Yep.
If you are traumatized, it's with you forever. But there are ways to live with it that aren't miserable.
Yeah.
You can be a joyful, vigorous, excited person and still be traumatized. Those things should be true.
And as you say, what she's trying to avoid, I suppose, is that very colonial Victorian thing of taxonomy, of sort of saying, this is this, this is categorised as this, in the same way that she doesn't want to be categorised as her trauma or indeed as British Cambodian, for example.
Absolutely.
To finish off, as I say, this is a wildly entertaining book to read. And I wondered, through your sort of assembling of it, whether there were particular moments that you enjoyed, whether that be any of your characters that you had pulled from time, or indeed the structure of the book itself.
My all-time favourite scene is the dinner party scene, where I got to bring Margaret Kemble, who's from The Great Plague of London, Arthur Reginald Smythe, who's from the First World War, Graham Gore, Victorian, and The Bridge all together in one room. That is almost untouched from the very first draft, partly because I just thought it would be really funny to make Graham cook spaghetti bolognese and for everyone to just negotiate, like putting on Spotify, smoking a joint. It's like, you know, it was just great fun. I loved writing Margaret, partly because she was a challenge to write, because getting her language right every single time took so much, you know, going over and over the sentences. And it wasn't in the first draft, but the Arctic sections that intersperse the main narrative. So those are the only parts of the book that aren't told from the Bridges' point of view.
Mm.
They are set on the Arctic expedition, they're in third person, and they are about Gore's experience on the expedition. I'm really very happy those are in there now, partly because not every reader will be as familiar with me as this expedition, and maybe slightly too familiar with it.
Maybe.
But also because it shows Gore himself experiencing something traumatic, which then affects the way he acts in the 21st century. And the Bridge can't see that. It's one of the reasons she misunderstands his intentions and misunderstands where their story ends up leading them.
Mm.
But I wanted it to be there for the reader, so that the reader could have a better sense of why Gore makes these decisions and why he says some of the things he says towards the end of the book.
Colleen, I can't thank you enough for telling us a little bit more about that book. I'm very sad that you're saying that your very serious, great Cambodian novel is never going to see the light of day. We'll be intrigued to see what comes next. But thank you so much for telling us about the Ministry of Time.
Thank you very much for having me.